If you haven't been here all of the weeks, or if you're new here, we're doing an Old Testament survey, a very, very broad brush survey through the whole Old Testament in 12 weeks. And one very helpful thing we found is that there are 11 timeline books. So often you read through your table of contents or flip through the Old Testament and maybe think, well, maybe this is pretty much in order or close to order. Well, it's not exactly that way, but there are 11 books that build on each other. Right when one book ends, the next book begins with a timeline, and they give us our timeline from the beginning of the Old Testament to the very end, 400 years before the New Testament. And we found that there are 11 of those books, and it's very helpful, I think, to view the Old Testament this way. And so let's see if we can kind of remember these timeline books. First one's easy. What's the first timeline book? Genesis, very good. What would be the main concept or the main word you remember from Genesis? Beginnings, very good. It is the book of beginnings. Does anyone happen to remember what the key chapter would be? Or what is found in that key chapter? It's a little tricky because there's a lot of chapters that could be a key chapter. And so obviously this is just one person's opinion. But chapter 12 is the Abrahamic covenant. Pretty big deal, very foundational covenant for all of time. And so we've got book of Genesis. It is the book of beginnings, and chapter 12 is the Abrahamic covenant. What is our second timeline book? What happens right after the end of Genesis? Exodus, very good. And what would be the key word or key theme of Exodus? It's deliverance, right? Deliverance. God grants deliverance. What's the key chapter? And I know these you probably don't have written down anywhere. The very, very first week, we kind of skimmed over the key chapters. But what word or event plays off of the word Exodus? Exile or the exit, like that exit sign right there, same word we're dealing with, to get out of somewhere. You have the Exodus. That is found in chapter 12, along with, they exit with Moses, but also the first Passover is found in this chapter. Exodus kind of has two key chapters. Chapter 12 is that, and then chapter 20 is the Ten Commandments, right? Exodus chapter 20, you want to think Ten Commandments. This is where they are found. So we've got Genesis, Exodus. What comes next? Be careful. Genesis, Exodus, Numbers. Very good. Genesis, Exodus, Numbers. So Leviticus does not progress the timeline. Leviticus takes place or fills in information during the book of Exodus. It gives a lot of different regulations, laws, rules, instructions from God during that time period of the Exodus. So we've got Genesis, Exodus, Numbers. What's a key theme or concept? Wonderings, very good. Wonderings and unbelief. What would be a key chapter? It's chapter 14. Does anyone remember what happened in chapter 14? Very good. Yeah, the spies, right? So how many total? 12 total spies. 10 came back scared and thinking, we can't do this. These people are giants. There's no way that we can overtake them. What was the problem with that, though? Problem was not that the people were big. Problem is they didn't have their faith and trust in God, that God could overcome whatever enemies they would have. How many spies came back with a good report, or rather with good faith in God? 2 spies. What were their names? Joshua and Caleb. Very, very good. So we've got Genesis, Exodus, Numbers. What comes next? Joshua. What is the key word or theme of Joshua? Conquest. Very good. Conquest of the Promised Land. Our key chapter is chapter 6. What happens there? What did you learn in Sunday school, like when you were a little kid? Chapter 6, Joshua leads the people in the Battle of Jericho. Joshua fought the battle, or Joshua fit the Battle of Jericho, depending on how you sing. All right, so we've got Genesis, Exodus, Numbers, Joshua. What comes next? Judges. Very good. What happened during the book of Judges? Cycle of sin, right? Cycle of the judges. It was not a good time. Key word, if you want to just write down failure, it was very much a time of failure. Chapter 2 is kind of the key chapter here. This is where that cycle of sin with the judges begins, chapter 2. What comes after the book of Judges? Very good. 1 Samuel. What would be the key word of 1 Samuel? Yes, that is correct. Perils of King Saul. It can also just be the monarchy. So 1 Samuel is kind of when we go from that time period of judges to the people saying, we want a king. We don't like this, how these judges are set up and what's happening. We want to be like every other nation. We want a king. And so, yes, very good. The perils of King Saul. He was the first king. Was he a good or bad king? Based off of the word perils. He was a bad king. Not a good king at all. Chapter 9 is where Saul becomes king in 1 Samuel. What's the next timeline book? Very easy. 2 Samuel. Who became king during the time of 2 Samuel? King David. He is a good or bad king? Very, very good king. Man after God's own heart. This is the first good king that Israel, God's people, have experienced. Now, what is the key chapter of 2 Samuel? This you have to know the rest of your life. 2 Samuel chapter 7, very good. What happened in chapter 7? The Davidic covenant, yes, extremely important, pertinent to their lives, to our lives, to eternity. 2 Samuel 7, Davidic covenant, memorize that. What comes next? So we got 1 and 2 Samuel, the kings, right? 1 and 2 Kings. What is the key theme or word of 1 Kings? The kingdoms divide, very good. We've got division. Chapter 12 is your key chapter. That is where the kingdoms divide into. What two kingdoms are they? What do we call those? We got the north and south. Who was the king over the north? You've got two Abom names. Rehoboam was king over the south. Jeroboam was king over the north. One of those was one of Solomon's sons, and that was Rehoboam. Jeroboam was just another guy kind of in that kingdom, a higher up in his kingdom, but Rehoboam was his actual blood relation, and this is where the line, that lineage that's promised, is passed through. That southern kingdom, which looked very small at the time compared to the northern kingdom, it only had two tribes in it compared to 10 tribes, but we see God fulfilling and continuing his promises through that southern kingdom. That's 1 Kings division. 2 Kings, our key word or key theme here is captivity. Captivity towards the middle or end of the book. So there has to be two key chapters here in 2 Kings. Chapter 17 is the north. Chapter 25 is the south. And these are the falls of those kingdoms. Now in the north, do y'all remember what year the north fell? 721 or 2? The north fell 721. And who did they fall to? Assyria. Very good. South fell in, and this is the date also of the exile. The south ultimately fell in what year? 586, very good, to the Babylonians. And again, that's the fall, that's the third stage of the fall of the south, which is also known as that exile. That's an important date to have memorized. 586 BC is when your exile starts. Now, depending on what sheet you're looking at, this sheet that has all of our timeline on it, that gray mark right there is the exile. And then the two books that we're looking at today, which is Ezra and Nehemiah. Ezra and Nehemiah, these finish out the timeline. So this comes right after this exile. So from last week to this week, you were in exile. This is what was happening in between last week and this week. So the book of Ezra, key concept or word is temple. You've got the temple foundation laid in the book of Ezra. Well, we can easily see that the book of Ezra continues the timeline. You can turn to the very beginning of Ezra, chapter 1, and this is where we can find out that it continues. In fact, the very last paragraph of 2 Chronicles, chapter 22 there, or I'm sorry, 2 Chronicles 36, verse 22 through verse 23, is the exact same wording as the beginning of the book of Ezra. I won't read the whole thing, but 2 Chronicles, very end there, says, "Now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled." And then the very beginning of the book of Ezra, chapter 1, same words. "In the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of God," or "the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled. The Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made proclamation throughout all of his kingdom, and also put it in writing. And it actually continues to repeat 2 Chronicles for another verse or two there. This happens sometimes. It's not always exactly word for word, but often if you find the end of a book in the Old Testament, if it's a timeline book, it's probably going to repeat in some variation exactly what just happened at that last timeline book. And here we have it word for word. If you're taking notes, I don't have a sheet for you this morning like I've had the last couple weeks. But if you remember how those work and you like taking notes, you can just on your own sheet of paper, just write those letters as we go. And I'll give those to you. Letter A is authorship. If you want to know the authorship of Ezra, here is what tradition says. Before that, Ezra and Nehemiah, this is a fact, were originally one book. That is something that I don't think I've ever heard before. We think 1 and 2 Samuel, Kings, Chronicles, obviously those were probably one book. That makes sense, right? They just split them and they numbered them. Well, actually, Ezra and Nehemiah were originally one book, just like those. Because of that, there's a little bit of different opinions on who wrote both of them or was half written by one, half written by the other. Again, we don't have any specific information in the text that tells us, but there's things we can draw information off of. The author speaks in the first person memoirs in this book, and so it seems like that Ezra is most likely the author here of the book of Ezra. And we'll talk about Nehemiah and how that works when we get to Nehemiah later today. So your author, most likely Ezra. And again, these two books were originally one book. Letter B, what is the purpose of this book? What is the purpose of the book of Ezra? Well, it's to show that God fulfills his promises. And so remember how in 1 Kings and 2 Kings, it was a pretty depressing time. And then we slide into 1 and 2 Chronicles, and it's a very, very bright time. It's a time of hope. Whoever wrote Chronicles, again, the name of the book is what's happening, they chronicle all the good out of that book of 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings. And it doesn't talk about all the sin, all the badness going on. It just gives you the way that God is working through, specifically that southern kingdom. Remember, it talks about David much. It gives chapter 10 to Saul and most of the rest of the book to David. It doesn't even mention David's sins with Bathsheba. It doesn't mention his problem with his son Absalom. It just tells you the good of what's happening. And so we're on the heels of that today. Ezra here picks up with an exciting time as well of God's promises coming to fruition. So again, 2 Chronicles tries to brighten up the view of God's people, the Israelites, as they're in exile, not a good time. Between last week, this week, we had the exile, and now we're starting to see these promises come to fruition, and that we'll look at here in a second in other places in Scripture, of these Israelites being told by God, I will bring you back someday. I promised you land many, many books ago, for our understanding, and you will get that back someday. And then we have even more detailed instructions on how long that will be once they get in it. And God promises it'll be 70 years. So remember the Israelites, they had been given their land with some specific rules on how God wanted that land governed. God was very specific on what they were to do. You don't just get to freely go roam this land however you want. You can have it, but you have to do it a certain way. They started well at first, but because of their disobedience, against the voice of the Lord, God kicked them out of the land. Now, remember back in Leviticus, God gave specific instruction on how he wanted that land cared for. That's Leviticus 25, 2 through 5. And I'll read that for us here real quick. Leviticus 25, 2 through 5. It's important we understand what they were supposed to do originally with their land. Here's the instructions. Speak to the people of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land that I give you, the land shall keep a Sabbath to the Lord. For 6 years you shall sow your field, and for 6 years you shall prune your vineyard and gather in its fruits. But in the seventh year there shall be a Sabbath of solemn rest for the land, a Sabbath to the Lord. You shall not sow your field or prune your vineyard. You shall not reap what grows of itself in your harvest, or gather the grapes of your undressed vine. It shall be a year of solemn rest for the land. Now, that's really, really important to understand, not only because they didn't obey that, but to see the consequences of how this plays out because they disobeyed these commands. Then in chapter 26 of Leviticus, verse 33, God says, if you don't obey all these things, I will scatter you from the land, and I will let the land enjoy its rest. That rest that God told them he wants that land to have. And this is what he did. They didn't obey it, and he kicked them out of the land, and that's what we call the exile. Now, to understand this, the timing here a little bit, looking at, again, in Leviticus 25, for 6 years you shall sow your field, and then in the seventh year you let the land rest. So, again, very practically, this isn't an analogy. If you're a farmer, or if you're not a farmer, we're in the Midwest here, just imagine a farmer can use a field for 6 full years. Do whatever you want with it, make it produce as much as possible. But on that seventh year, you cannot use that land. You cannot sow on there. You have to let it rest. Let it have its Sabbath or its rest. Well, they disobeyed this, most likely just because of greed, right? So if you have 7 years of very bountiful harvest, what are you going to be tempted to do? I'm sorry, if you have 6 years of very bountiful harvest, you're going to think, well, I'm not going to waste a whole entire year. This is going to make me more wealthy or have more goods, so I'm going to go ahead and just use it. God told them not to do that, though, but this is what they did. And they did this for 490 years, and that's where we get a 70-year exile. For every year that on that seventh year the land didn't get to rest, that's going to add up to 70 years of exile. So God is going to get restitution for that land. He doesn't let things slide. And so that's where we get that number 490. That's 70 times 7. That's how long they disobeyed. And because of that, that's the exile. 1 year of exile for every time they disobeyed. Jeremiah 25, 10 through 12, and a very, very familiar passage here, Jeremiah 29, 10 through 11, and you can turn there with me if you'd like, gives us a continuation of this promise and what God is going to do, specifically speaking of this part of the timeline, right at the end of the exile, when they're going to go back into the land. So if you've ever wondered what's the actual context of Jeremiah 29, 11, which is so often said and repeated and tattooed on people's bodies or put in their houses, this is your context. Jeremiah 29, we'll start in verse 10. Jeremiah 29, 10. For thus says the Lord, when 70 years are completed for Babylon, I will visit you, and I will fulfill to you my promise and bring you back to this place. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans for welfare and not for evil, to give you a future and a hope. Then you will call upon me and come and pray to me, and I will hear you. This is a wonderful promise. That's the context again of God telling these people, when that 70 years is fulfilled, I will bring you back to your land as I promised you. And in that context, I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to make you prosper. And then he says, but then you will obey my commandments. Then you will love me. Again, this is a wonderful promise, and this is speaking of the Israelites coming back into their land. Let us see if you're taking notes. Main concept. What is the main concept of Ezra? Well, we said this earlier. It's the temple being built. The temple being built. And we'll dig into that a little more here. A few more letters. Letter D, key chapter. Our key chapter is Ezra chapter 6. This is the foundation being laid in the book of Ezra. And we have pretty detailed instructions throughout the book of Ezra and Nehemiah on how all of this was reconstructed. But key chapter is Ezra chapter 6. Letter E, the outline. What is the outline of the book? Well, it's two parts. It's very simple. Letter A is Zerubbabel's return. And this is chapters 1 through 6. Zerubbabel's return. And then letter B, Ezra's return, chapters 7 through 10. So this book splits nearly in half, 1 through 6, 7 through 10. Even from that, you can start seeing that all of the Israelites did not come back from exile at one time, back to their land in Israel. Often, that's probably a general assumption when we hear, you know, people were taken into captivity, you think they just all went at once. Well, we know they didn't. They went in three different stages to Babylon over many years. Same thing coming back. They didn't all just swoop back at once right when God says, I'll bring you back. There's three different returns. Ezra has two of those returns, and Nehemiah has one of those returns. And so here's the kind of the main body of what we'll do today. Letter F, progression by chapter. And we're just going to walk through each chapter and kind of give a quick summary of what's in that chapter. Some books are laid out in a way that you can look at four different men and four different events, like the book of Genesis. They're kind of structured different ways. This book is a little more difficult to pick out things like that, so we're just going to go chapter by chapter, quick summary. That's how it'll work today. So, letter A, back to the outline, and then we'll go through the chapters under this part of the outline. Zerubbabel's return. In chapter 1, we see the decree of Cyrus. The decree of Cyrus. This is the king of Persia. So Babylon took the south into captivity in 586. That's our exile. So 47 years later, Persia captures Babylon. So if you think Israelites went into captivity and the Babylonians just had them the whole entire time for 70 years, that's not necessarily true. Persia overcame Babylon 47 years into the exile. That was in 539 BC. This happened most likely with the help of Daniel. Cyrus issued a decree allowing the Jews to return to their homeland and rebuild their temple. So number one, the decree of Cyrus. That is chapter one. The decree that the king, and you can see God working through this earthly king says, all right, I'll go ahead and let you go back to your land. You see God sovereignly working through human instruments. In chapter 2, we see the return to the land. And really, again, this is the first of three returns. They didn't all come back at once. And if you want to jot down kind of the category of returns, there was a chart in this curriculum. I didn't print it off, but it's just a three-stage chart. Return number one is with Zerubbabel. Return number two is with Ezra. And then return number three is with Nehemiah. So it's pretty simple. You've got the two books, and then at the beginning of Ezra, you've got Zerubbabel. Really, there, one guy said there could have been three Bible books. Just equally call it the book of Zerubbabel, Ezra, and Nehemiah. Because these three returns are very, very compatible and seem fairly equal. Not necessarily with number of people. But those are your three returns back to their promised land after that 70-year exile. So chapter 2, the first return, this is where Zerubbabel would lead a group of almost 50,000 people back to the promised land. And you can see this in chapter 2 of Ezra. Ezra 2, verse 64. The whole assembly together was 42,360, beside their male and female servants, of whom there were 7,337, and they had 200 male and female singers. So about 50,000 people is in this first return. Moving into chapter 3 now. Chapter 3, we have the kind of beginning stages of rebuilding this temple. And really, chapter 3 just tells us about the foundation of this temple being laid. Now, upon arriving in the land, the first thing they did was build an altar. This is chapter 3, verse 2. Then arose Jeshua, the son of Jozadak, with his fellow priest, and Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, with his kinsmen, and they built the altar of God of Israel to offer burnt offerings on it, as is written in the law of Moses, the man of God. Now, think about this for a second. They were just thrown out of their land for 70 years of disobedience. What do you think the first thing they did right when they got back to that land was? Well, they obeyed. Whatever it was, they obeyed, because they just were exiled for 70 years, and they didn't want that again. This is a little bit of an extreme example, but imagine you went to prison for 20 years for not paying a mortgage. Imagine the end of that 20 years comes and they say, all right, we're going to release you to your house. And you know that mortgage is still not paid off yet. What's the first thing you're going to do when you get out of prison? Go make that first payment or whatever payment you can possibly make. Because you're freed now, but you're not completely free. You still have to do something, and that is pay that mortgage, or they'll throw you back in prison. I know that's not how this works, and it's an extreme example. But think, these Israelites got taken out of the land for disobedience to God for 70 years. They're released, but again, it's not just freely go do what you want with the land. All of these laws that God has said are still in place. And so because of that, the first thing they do is go set up an altar. Right when they get back to the land, it's like, all right, we want to make sure we do this right, and we're going to worship God first thing we do. Set up this altar and start making sacrifices. And that's what we find in chapter 3. Also here in chapter 3, they did any preliminary work that needed to be done, such as clearing away debris, and then they laid the foundation for the temple. That's chapter 3, verse 10. You can see that. And you can also see a celebration happening there as this foundation is being laid. There was, seems like, much music and singing and praising, giving thanks to the Lord. They said, actually, "For he is good, for his steadfast love endures forever toward Israel." Moving on to chapter 4. Chapter 4 of the book of Ezra, you start seeing opposition to this rebuilding. Not everyone was glad to see the Jews back in their land. There was a group of adversaries that got in the way of this project by threatening the Jews and then hiring lawyers, it seems like, to oppose them in court. That's chapter 4, verse 1 through 5. Sadly, these opposers and lawyers were successful. They stopped the project for about 15 years. They started laying that foundation, and then that halted for 15 years. And I think it's helpful to think through that for a second. You've got disobedience, you've got exile, God fulfilling what he said he would do if you disobey him. Now you've got a time of promise. They're taken out of exile, God's sending them back to their promised land. Everything's wonderful, it seems like, in our mind. I think we can easily have this just very picturesque view of the Israelites going back and everything's peachy. And it's just them and their land. Well, it's not just them and their land, and there's still much opposition even as they're going back to their land. Not only that, they begin building this temple, which God wanted them to do, and they don't even freely get to build it. There's people trying to stop the project. It would be easy to think in those situations, what's happening? Does God care? Is he here? I thought he was leading us back, which is what he wanted to do even. Why is this a struggle? These are easy times to begin wondering what's going on, and that happens with our life so much. We think, well, I'm obeying God's commands and promises. I'm doing what he wants here as a 21st century Christian. I'm living a holy life. Why is it difficult? Why is there opposition? Well, because that's, again, to make it very plain and simple, that's reality. These ideas and pictures that everything's just going to work smoothly if you're a Christian or you're obeying God is not how this sinful world works. That doesn't mean God's not there, though. In fact, he is. And he is completely sovereign and in control, even in these times. But I can't imagine what these Israelites were thinking when they were getting their land back, beginning to build a temple to serve the Lord, and they got stopped for 15 years. I mean, think of how much we're instantly gratified in our day and age. It's like, oh, wait, we want this, and we better have it by tomorrow. They're back in their land. They have to wait 15 years to continue to build this temple. Chapter 5 looks up a little bit here. It's the return to rebuilding the temple. This is after that 15 years. This is where the prophets Haggai and Zechariah enter the scene, and you can see that right at the beginning of chapter 5. Now the prophets Haggai and Zechariah, the son of Iddo, prophesied to the Jews who were in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of God of Israel who was over them. Then Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Jeshua, the son of Jozadak, arose and began to rebuild the house of God that is in Jerusalem. And the prophets of God were with them, supporting them. So you see these two prophets that God sent, bringing wonderful news and bringing a great hope to the people, even to Zerubbabel. And it makes it seem like they were kind of moping for 15 years. And then as soon as these prophets came, they kind of jumped up and said, all right, let's go continue to build this temple. This is again in chapter 5. They begin to preach and prophesy in the name of the Lord, and they motivated these people to continue on this project. Again, not without opposition. There's still opposition there. There's still people trying to stop this project, but nevertheless, they continue. Chapter 6, the temple is completed. Chapter 6, after 4 years of hard work, the construction was finally finished, and the temple was dedicated. In chapter 6, verse 14 through 18, you see a dedication ceremony there, dedicating this temple to the Lord. This was a massive celebration. You've got 100 bulls, 200 rams, 400 lambs, and other things being sacrificed as sin offerings to the Lord. That's a lot of animals. So right here, the temple's completed as a celebration. There seems to be about a 50-year break. So right in the middle of the book of Ezra, you've got chapters 1 through 6, the first return. Those people start working in the land. And then there's a 50-year break as far as our time here in the book of Ezra until chapter 7 starts, which is the second return. Now we'll let Dave fill in more of this next week. This is just one thing I heard. There's a possibility that the book of Esther, which is in this timeline, if you look at this sheet here, the book of Esther is right here after the exile under the book of Ezra. It seems like that story of Esther probably took place during this little 50-year break between the first return and the second return of the people. But you'll probably get more on that next week. So we just looked at the six chapters of Zerubbabel's return. Now, letter B, Ezra's return, chapters 7 through 10. So the rest of the book of Ezra, second return, he leads the people. Now he is the leader back to the land. Now there was approximately 80 years after this return, the return of Zerubbabel, when Ezra came on the scene as far as leading the people back. He's a scribe and he now takes 1,500 people back to the land. So you had 50,000 people in the first return. Now you've got 1,500 people. Again, this is the second return. Ezra and the people take with them a very large amount of money, of goods, back to Jerusalem. Number one, to help the people that are already there in Jerusalem, but also to teach them the law of God. That was one reason why Ezra was going back to the land, to encourage them and to make sure that these people that are back in their promised land make sure that they obey God. Because what happens if they don't? Well, they would get kicked out again. They didn't at this point. But that's why Ezra is going. Ezra is a very godly man. Chapter 7, verse 6 tells us he was a scribe skilled in the law of Moses. And verse 10 says, "For Ezra had set his heart to study the law of the Lord and to do it and teach his statutes and rules in Israel." Ezra is a wonderful leader. This is the type of leader you want, someone that has dedicated themselves to study the law of the Lord and to do it and teach those statutes and rules to the people. This moves us to chapter 8. Chapter 8 is just a continuation of the journey to Jerusalem. Here in chapter 8, you have a big list of everyone that went with Ezra. And then at the end, you have some information on the rest of the journey. Little stops they took, places they went, things they did on their way back to the promised land. And in chapter 8, verse 18, you have a very important phrase that you see a lot through the book of Ezra and Nehemiah. In fact, I can't remember if they said it's only in these two books in the whole Bible. If not, it's in these two books by far the most. And this phrase is, "And the good hand of our God was upon us." This is mentioned many times in Nehemiah and some in Ezra as well. This is an important phrase, "the good hand of our God was upon us." Imagine the comfort because of Ezra and Nehemiah's understanding and how they knew that when obedience is happening, God's hand's upon them. Them preaching that and teaching the people that. Imagine the comfort of people understanding, wow, when we obey, God is with us. He loves what we're doing. He'll protect us. He'll guide us. This is what this important phrase, this key phrase is, "the good hand of our God is upon us." Chapter 9, this is reformation of the people under Ezra. The reformation of the people under Ezra. Remember how the people were very diligent to obey God the moment they got back into the land. Well, you can think through all the cycles of humanity up until this point. What do you think happened again? Well, they fall again. And sadly, the people of Israel once again began to compromise God's laws, especially with their intermarrying with pagans. We've seen this problem with kings, right? Saul, David, and Solomon. Solomon especially, we looked at that last week. He began to intermarry with other foreign women, which God commanded not to do. Which, by the way, is not just a mere command to not. Some people bring this up as like something that's racism. It's like that's craziness. The point is not just we just don't want you marrying other nations or ethnicities or whatever it is. The point is the next verse in this prohibition given in Deuteronomy 7. And the reason you're not supposed to intermarry with other foreign women is this: "For they would turn away your sons from following me to serve other gods." That's the reason. It has nothing to do with the nationalities. If the nations didn't try to convince other nations to serve other gods, there wouldn't be a problem. The prohibition is because it will turn your heart away from serving the one true living God. And remember exactly what happened with Solomon? That very thing. He married these wives. He let them bring their gods into the nation, which is the first mistake. And then he built platforms and altars for those other gods in Israel while he was the king, which is the second mistake, letting the people do that. And then Solomon ended up worshiping those other gods. You see that progression of how it turned his heart away from the one true living God. So with this happening, this decline, Ezra came into the picture, being a man of God who knew the law of God very well. He quickly picked up on what was happening, and he led the people back to obedience of the Lord. You can view this as kind of a revival. Revivals definitely happen throughout Scripture. This is one of them. Revival meaning bringing back to life or turning back to worship. So anytime a revival has to happen, that means something not good is happening, by the way. Piper's little phrase, missions exist because worship doesn't. You can think revivals exist because worship doesn't. Otherwise, you wouldn't need a revival. But because of their turning away from the Lord, they needed this to happen. All right. That leads us to the book of Nehemiah. Book of Nehemiah. Again, this is the same book as Ezra originally, all one book, Ezra and Nehemiah, written together in sorts. Now, we saw that the first person memoirs in the book of Ezra pointed to the fact that Ezra was probably the author. We have those as well in the book of Nehemiah, that first person speaking. And so it seems like Nehemiah was probably the author of the book of Nehemiah. But some people say that he possibly wrote some things down, but it was actually in Ezra's hands with the finished work to take those and maybe add on a little bit, I'm not sure, and combine this together as one book. Again, different people see different things. Some people say Ezra wrote the whole entire thing, Ezra and Nehemiah. I would say the majority view Ezra writing the book of Ezra, Nehemiah writing the book of Nehemiah. And because Ezra was a very skilled scribe, Ezra possibly combining these two together. You see that in Ezra 7:11, talking about him being a very skilled scribe at the time. But the very beginning of the book of Nehemiah, chapter 1, verse 4, says, "As soon as I heard these words, I sat down and wept." You hear that I language, that first-person memoir. And this is Nehemiah talking. That's letter A, the authorship. Letter B, what is the main concept of the book of Nehemiah? The main concept is the walls of Jerusalem being rebuilt. Not only just the walls, though, and we'll look at this. This is rebuilding the walls of the city, but also rebuilding the people. These very godly men, like Ezra and Nehemiah, they didn't just care about making structures. They cared that the people served the Lord. And this is exactly what they did. Letter C, your key chapter. Key chapter is Nehemiah 6. This is where the walls are rebuilt. And this is roughly 10 years after Ezra. So you can kind of view that time period. You've got Ezra going to the land. About 10 years later, you've got Nehemiah now taking a group of people to the land. This is the third return, the third and last return of God's people getting back to their land. Your outline here, again, just a two-part outline. Letter A is rebuilding the walls, and B is spiritual reform. That rebuilding the walls is chapter 1 through 7. Again, not directly in half, but just kind of imagine this book being split in half. And then B, spiritual reform takes place, chapter 8 through 13. And letter E, the key point here. Key point of the book of Nehemiah. Well, there is much overlap in Ezra and Nehemiah. This, again, it's very important. They're not just two books compiled back to back, completely progressing the timeline. Imagine these two books kind of overlapping a little bit like this. These men worked together. They were co-laborers, but you just have kind of two different perspectives or accounts going on here. You kind of see that, or you see the background, rather, in Ezra chapter 4, verse 6 through 23. And this is the background information for why Nehemiah was sorrowful in chapter 1. And that's how Nehemiah 1 starts off. He's sorrowful of what's going on in the land. And it was because the king put a halt on the building of that project. Remember that little 15-year halt? Well, Nehemiah is sorrowful for that while that's happening. You can see that overlap. And then because of this, it led Nehemiah to go to the land and build these walls. Nehemiah chapter 8 and chapter 12, verse 26, makes it clear that these two men were ministering together. Chapter 12 gives an account of Nehemiah being there, and you can view Nehemiah a little more as like kind of a judge of the place or of the city. some sort of town counselor. Ezra, view him more as a priest. He's a scribe and a priest, it calls him. These two men co-labor together. And you see Ezra in chapter 12 there, reading the law to all the people, while Nehemiah, I'm sure, is there present. And so letter F, the progression by chapter, same thing as Ezra. We'll go a little quicker this time. So under the first section, rebuilding the walls, chapter 1 through 7, chapter 1, you have Nehemiah mourning the sins of the people. This is all that whole entire paragraph from chapter 4 all the way down to, verse 4 all the way down to verse 11. It's the bulk of chapter 1. Nehemiah is mourning and pleading with the Lord that the Lord would turn and forgive his people and change their ways and their hearts. Nehemiah here in chapter 1, he heard from his brother Hanani of the oppression or opposition in Jerusalem. Nehemiah spent about 4 months in prayer during that one section in chapter 1. Nehemiah is praying for 4 months. He continually confessed the sins of the people to God and asked God to hear him and forgive the people. I would ask, do we take sin that seriously? Imagining someone praying for 4 months to intercede for people. That's an amazing feat and an amazing man of God. Chapter 2, you see Nehemiah's request to the king to return to Jerusalem. This is about approximately 10 years after Ezra, as we mentioned. Nehemiah is afraid of looking sad in front of the king, it says, but then he lays out his requests, probably crying at the time, to go to the land and rebuild the walls, and the king grants him his request. The idea there was you're not really supposed to mourn or be sad in front of the king, it seems like, and so he was afraid to go and ask, knowing that he is mourning. He went ahead and did it. The Lord was with him, and the king granted his request. It says he then goes and he sneaks around one night in the land, so he makes his journey, and he's not just in broad daylight returning to the land thinking, all right, here's how we're going to start building these walls. No, he sneaks around at night there in Jerusalem, seeing what happened, what kind of destruction was there, and what he's going to have to do, kind of getting a blueprint or a formulation of what's, you know, how many people is he going to need to build these walls again. And that is there in chapter 2. Again, that even points us to seeing that there's still much opposition in the promised land of the people. There's still many enemies there because he has to sneak around at night. Chapter 3 is the building of the wall. This records an extremely detailed blueprint of how the wall was constructed and who all was involved. And I mean extremely detailed. All of chapter 3 is telling you this group of people who are the sons of these people did this exact portion of the wall, and here's how they did it. It's amazing. The whole entire chapter 3, from verse 1 all the way to the end, is just giving you instruction and explanation of how Nehemiah rebuilt this wall and who he built it with. Chapters 4, 5, and 6, again, we face opposition. It's easy to think, well, we're obeying the Lord, so things should be easy. Even in our life, it's easy to think that way, but this is not how it works. Again, these three chapters is people opposing him, trying to stop him, shows us a very important point that we've discussed already. Specifically, there was two men Nehemiah kept being confronted by, and their names are Sanballat and Tobiah. These are really annoying people and very bad men, by the way. Like little gnats. They would not leave Nehemiah alone, trying to stop this project and halt it. They were both childish and very aggressively trying to kill Nehemiah. At one point in chapter 4, verse 3, they said, if a fox goes up on this wall that you're building, this whole wall would crumble. And the point of that is just they're making fun of him. It's like, why are you doing this? They didn't want him to do it, so they're trying to give little jabs, such as the weight of a small fox would crumble your wall. And so you see their childishness, but also they scheme to try to kill Nehemiah at different times. You see Nehemiah knowing that that's going to happen and hiding or moving from a different location to where they were going to try to kill him, all while conducting this building project of the wall. Because of these men and others who were trying to attack, Nehemiah did two things. He had a group of men building the wall, and he also had a group of men standing on guard with weapons, as if the wall's back here and men are laboring to build that, and then you've got a line of men here with swords, shields, whatever they had. but a group of men or a line of men protecting them so that that wall project can continue. That's the idea there. Nehemiah was also a God-fearing man like Ezra, and he led his people very well. He reminded them in chapter 4, verse 14, to not be afraid of these enemies, to remember that the Lord who is great and awesome and fights for your brother, and you need to fight for your brothers and your sons and your daughters, your wives and your homes. Why? Because the Lord is with you. This is, again, displaying the very wonderful leader that Nehemiah is. At the end of chapter 6, this wall is finally finished, and it says that the wall took 52 days to build, which in my mind is very impressive. I was trying to look up different schemes or how large this wall was. However large it was, that's very impressive to build a large, massive stone wall around a city in 52 days. And we've got like interstate projects that have been going on my whole life. So this is, I think, extremely, extremely impressive. That kind of also shows how many men were working on this wall and how the Lord was backing that and protecting them to allow them to keep working. Chapter 7, Nehemiah's registration of the people. This is a good registration, unlike the one David took. Now that these walls are up, Nehemiah enrolls the people by genealogies. He also organizes a militia to protect the city. And so don't imagine that all Israelites get to live inside these walls in the city. That's not how it happened. In fact, there was probably many more. I think one place said that 1/10 were allowed to come in and live in the city, apart from like the tribe of the Levites and stuff who got to live in there already. And so you've got people in the city, around the walls, still in the promised land though. All of them living together. And this is Nehemiah now goes from a building project manager to kind of a judge or orchestrator of the whole city. He's a very busy man. He has a lot on his hands. It's important to note that although the walls were essentially finished, much more work needed to be done, both in strengthening the walls and rebuilding the city itself. And you can see that in chapter 7, verse 1 through 4. It wasn't just like walls go up 52 days and boom, we're done and we live life. There was a lot more work that had to be done, but the walls were at least constructed. And then chapters 8 through 13, letter B, we'll finish this out real quick. This is your spiritual reform. This is how the book ends. So remember, Ezra, Nehemiah, even Zerubbabel, they weren't just men to orchestrate physical things and move people around and build structures. They were men of God to also lead the people towards the living God, make sure that they are obeying him. They were spiritual leaders as well. Not just construction workers. Chapter 8, Ezra reads God's word to the people. Again, this is that little co-laboring event of Nehemiah and Ezra, both working together to make sure the people loved God as they should and obeyed him. Chapters 9 through 10 is another revival and its results. And any great revival is based squarely on the word of God. Again, revival is a new beginning of obedience to God and his word. Chapter 10 shows us the people were committed to changed lives and committed to obedience to God. And just from a revival happening, you can see that even in this good time, after the third return, there's still another dip in obedience from the people. And they have to be pulled out of that by their leaders, Nehemiah and Ezra, to continue to be faithful. Chapters 11 through 12 is the repopulation of the land. Again, Nehemiah transitioned from being this wall builder now to a city manager, now to a orchestrator of repopulation. He handled different aspects of organization and structured the repopulation of the land to be one of pure Jewish descent. So he's a man of many talents. And then chapter 13, the last chapter, sadly, is the drifting of the people again. We had such a wonderful time going on. There's a few dips in it. Hoping the book would end well, the very end of our timeline of the whole Old Testament. Let's end with a good note. And no, chapter 13 is the drifting of the people. When Nehemiah left Jerusalem, much of his influence left also. During his absence, people began to drift back into their sins of their forefathers. So when he returned, he immediately began to deal with the people to convict them of their wrongdoing. Nehemiah knew if violations of the law continued, it would bring discipline back on the people. Just as they disobeyed with how they were supposed to work the land, they got thrown out. Nehemiah is aware of this, and he's a man who fears the Lord. Thus, he's driven to obey the Lord. Even just the end of this book shows the importance of having good leaders. Every time these leaders would go even just a little bit away, people would start drifting back into sin because they're living autonomously. They're on their own. They're living in their own ways and thoughts. This shows us we need good leaders, leaders like Ezra and Nehemiah, but specifically it's told us that Ezra set his mind and set his heart to the law of the Lord, that he would know it and that he would teach it to the people. Again, in our day and age, in our world of so much pushback to authority, this is a prime example. Authority is a good thing. We need authority. We need leaders. Otherwise, people, and then even we would drift into our own sin when we're not grounded in Scripture. So from this point, this is the end of the Old Testament as we know it or we have it, as far as the timeline's concerned. And from this point, there's no inspired account for 400 years. End of the book of Nehemiah here till Matthew, when we have a proclamation of the Messiah coming. 400 years of a break or a time period pause in Israel's history that we don't have any, again, inspired writings or recordings of. There are some writings in there, of course. Let me end it very abruptly and pray for us here and